It's WSB's Money Matters with Wes Moss. Certified financial planner and chief investment strategist from Atlantis Capital Investment Advisors. Wes talks to you about investing and saving for the future. Brought to you every Sunday by RBM of Atlanta, Mercedes-Benz, Sandy Springs.
TJ from Lawrence Hill. TJ, good morning. Welcome to Money Matters. How can I help, my friend?
Hi, good morning. So I have a defined benefit pension plan that I can either take a lump sum or take an annuity. The lump sum would be about, I don't know if you want to hear numbers or not.
Sure, numbers make it fun.
Yeah, so the numbers are, as of June 30th of last year, 2016, it was about $137,500.
Okay, that is the lump sum offer.
Right.
Okay.
And they're saying the monthly annuity of that would be $870, which is, I'm sure, is just myself and not including my wife's shared benefit to that.
All right. So that, again, and we would call that a single life annuity. So it covers you. Is that typically you at least have the, do you have the option to do one that covers your spouse for life, TJ?
Yes. You know, it would be something less than $870.
A little bit less. Okay. So it's always good to start with the what is really just called the single life option. So, and you've probably done the test here, but there's a lot of variables. Let's start quickly with the test. So the 6% test simply is you take your monthly amount, multiply it by 12, right? So 870 times 12 is 10,440. And then we just divide that by what you would otherwise be able to get in a lump sum payment, $137,500. So that equals a 7.59% effectively guaranteed rate of return, which is pretty darn good. And the way I look at these pensions is that anything, if the monthly income equates to a 6% return of capital, rate of return, however you want to think about it, because some of this is your own money they're just giving you back. Remember that too.
Okay.
Because you could otherwise take the $137,500. That's your money. And then you can, on your own, produce 5, 6, 7% a year over time. Otherwise, what you're doing here is you're giving it back to them, and then they're just guaranteeing this. So I always ask, so from a numerically, that certainly beats the 6% test, which lends itself to take the monthly amount and not take the lump sum. If you're well 6% or higher, you start to say, well, wait a minute, this monthly amount is pretty good to be able to have your own investment account effectively guarantee 7.5% a year forever. That's a pretty hard hurdle to guarantee yourself, right?
Right.
The difference, though, here. Would it vary? The first question here is, though, how much further does it go down if you cover your spouse? Because something happens to you in year three. Now, your family really missed out because you could have had $137,000. You only took a payment of $10,440 for 3 years. You only got $31,000. You left over $100,000 on the table.
Right.
So TJ, that's the question mark, and that's why. How old are you guys? How much younger is your wife? Younger or older?
She's just 6 months younger.
So
I'm 66.
You're both mid 60s. I would say that again, from a planning perspective. Typically, wives have a longer life expectancy. That's obviously impossible to forecast. But I think that the next question goes into, how about the other retirement income? Have you started taking social yet? Social Security?
Just started this month.
And then, do you have any other pensions from any other companies, and/or does your wife have a pension?
No, there was another pension I had with a previous company. I took the lump sum on that a couple of years ago and invested in a self-directed IRA. It's been kind of going sideways since then.
What year, TJ, what year, how long has it been going sideways?
But I think it'll be 2 years in July.
Got it. Okay. So I guess my question is this. I always go back to the gap. You've got social, your wife has social, and you both started. What does that add up to every month now?
Well, she's not drawing hers yet. She's going to draw, she's eligible to take her spousal Social Security, because she earned her own Social Security, which was not insignificant. So she's going to take her spousal Social Security beginning at 66 when she in November, and then when she turns 70, she'll apply for her own Social Security, which will be about $3,300 a month. I'm getting $2,561 a month gross.
So that is $5,800 a month, which is pretty significant.
Right.
How much? I guess my question is: if that's the case, and you've already got this other IRA money, well, how much other investment money do you guys have?
So total dollars, including this $138,000. So I guess the bottom line question is: should I take the $800 a month, roughly? Or should I take the lump sum and add it to the $2 million I have of investable income, investable dollars?
So you've already got another $2 million that is ready to produce income for you.
Right.
And that's a big variable. So if you told me, TJ, if you said, you know, I've got $100,000 in one IRA, and if I take this $138,000 as a lump sum, I'd have another $138,000, so I'd have $238,000 total. I'd say, you know what, TJ, even though the monthly amount is a really good number, a solid rate of return that's virtually guaranteed. Again, and it's a low enough amount that even if the company that is giving it to you goes out of business, God forbid, it's still going to be covered by the PBGC, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, right?
Right, yeah.
Because it's under a certain level.
Yeah, the company's been around for 100 years. That's one thing I asked them, is that I'd want to make sure they weren't selling that or buying an annuity from some insurance company, and they're not.
Got it. So either way, it's safe. And I'd say that if you didn't have a whole lot of other liquid retirement savings money, IRAs and non-IRAs, so brokerage accounts, and there's anything that you can get to, then I'd say, you know what, TJ, you need to take the lump sum. Even though you've got this great 7.5% rate of return, I'd say if you've only got another $100,000 total saved, then you need to take that lump sum because it needs to be part of the overall retirement plan, and it's the flexible money you can get to. However, in your particular case, you've got plenty of other liquidity. You've got another $2 million that's already saved. Yeah. I would look at this and say, you know what, this is what's the math on that? 135 divided by 2 million is about 7% of your money. Well, yeah. You probably have 7%. You're going to have, as a balanced income investor, let's say, you're still going to have a fairly significant percentage in bonds and things that are there for safety and stability and income. I'd look at that money as part of that equation and say, you know what, I can't get a guaranteed 7.5% anywhere else. I might as well take the monthly pension amount and count that towards my fixed income or my bond, my safe allocation, because you have plenty of other money that you can get to. And you can now make the financial decision and say, well, that's a really good deal. And I bet you even if you take the spousal amount that your wife is covered for the rest of her life, which I believe you probably want to do.
I will, yeah.
It's not going to go down dramatically. It's not as if it's going to go down to 4.5% rate of return. Usually, I'll see it drop by maybe 1%. So I bet you it'll still meet the 6% test. I bet you it'll still be 6.25, 6.5 to cover both of your lives. And that makes it a pretty good deal for your particular situation to take that monthly amount and not take the lump sum. So that would be my vote. But knowing now more about the bigger picture for TJ, for you and your wife, I would lean towards, in your particular case, I'd be leaning towards taking technically the guarantee by either people, whether you say it's guaranteed by the company or the PBGC, either way, that I'd make that part of your overall investment allocation, because it's pretty tough to guarantee yourself 6.5 to 7% otherwise. And you look at this as a really important sliver of the pie or piece of the pie for your overall planning. And I think in your particular case, the monthly amount can make a lot of sense. Sharon, how can we help? What's going on?
Well, good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
My pleasure.
My question is, as I turn 70 in October, And I believe at 70 and a half, you are required to take a distribution from both your 401k and your IRA.
Yes.
Correct?
Correct.
Okay. So I went online and looked at some chart, and for my age and what have you, it said 27.5, which came out to be about $15,000 for that first year.
Yeah, it's a little less than 4% of the value of your IRAs and your 401k.
Okay. And so if that's going to affect me, I live completely on Social Security. How much of that $15,000 is going to end up, all of it's going to be taxable, correct?
Well, it depends on your tax rate, Sharon. If your only income is Social Security income and you don't have any other pensions or anything like that, then your overall tax rate, because your adjustable gross income will be relatively low, your overall tax rate will be low. So the $15,000 that comes out of the IRA, it's just like a paycheck back when you were working. Except you don't have to pay FICA on it, so you don't have to pay Social Security, Medicare tax on it. And are you in Georgia, by the way?
Yes, I am.
So in the state of Georgia, once you're past 65, you've got a big $65,000 Georgia state tax exemption, and Social Security doesn't even count towards that. So you're not going to have to pay Georgia tax on it. You don't pay FICA on it. So really, it's just going to be whatever your federal tax rate is, Sharon.
Right.
And from what I can tell, and again, you haven't even given me any numbers, but it's probably, and again, check with CPA. I have to give you a disclosure on this, but it's probably 10% or even less. So it's because your overall effective tax rate is going to be relatively in check. That allows you to, your tax rate's not going to be that high. So you're going to do, so it helps to do some withholding. So when you take your required minimum distributions from your IRA, from your 401k, you're going to want to withhold money, and that money will go right to the feds, right to the IRS. That way you don't owe anything at the end of the year.
Now here's more great money and investment advice from certified financial planner Wes Moss.
Daryl, who joins us on the line. Daryl from Conyers, what's going on? How can we help?
Morning, Wes. The new proposed corporate tax cut, will that apply just to C corps, or will it apply to S corps and proprietorships as well?
I spent a lot of time trying to figure out and really revisiting, Daryl, what this tax reform will look like or could look like. And you can find this. So anybody that's interested in figuring out what these proposals are, they're at abetterway.speaker.gov. So the website, abetterway.speaker.gov, and there's a lot of detail behind this. If you go to your specific question, is a giant one. It's probably the most significant piece of all of this, and it doesn't get a lot of press because you're asking about pass-through entities, and no, they're different. So if you have an LLC or an S corp, and you're a small business owner, like most small business owners do, you're taxed at your individual rate, pass-through meaning that you earn income and the business earns income, and then all of it, what's left at the end of the year, passes through to you, and then it applies back to whatever your individual rate is. Now, remember, the individual rates are supposed to change under tax reform. And the Ryan plan and the Trump plan both are calling for pretty simple tax brackets, 12%, 25%, 33%. From a pass-through perspective, though, the Ryan plan wants a top rate of 25%, which, if you think about it, if you own a business and you've got tons of income coming through that would normally be at today's 39.6 or even under the new plan 33, the Ryan plan proposes if it's coming as a pass-through, as a business owner, it would be at a top rate of 25.
Okay.
Really significant difference for business owners. And think about this for a minute. Think about that word spreading that, hey, it's efficient, tax efficient to be a business owner or start a business. Think about the potential for job creation there. Now, under the revised Trump plan, there's talk about having that at a 15% rate, which is similar to his corporate rate, right? That would be even more significant. So that's a huge part of this legislation that we need to pay attention to. Because it's a job, it's potentially very similar for jobs, and it's a big change if you're a business owner out there.
It's is Money Matters with Wes Moss, certified financial planner and chief investment strategist from Atlantis Capital Investment Advisors. Wes talks to you about investing and saving for the future. Brought to you every Sunday by RBM of Atlanta, Mercedes-Benz, Sandy Springs.
We're going to go right to the phones here. Let's start with Gerald, who joins us on the line from Jasper. Gerald, what's going on? Good morning. How can we help?
Good morning, Wes. Thank you for taking my call. I do listen to your podcast, and I will have to get on there and give you great reviews.
Thanks, man.
Thank you so much for what you do.
I appreciate it. Well, how can I help today? What's going on?
Well, last week you were talking about brick-and-mortar stores, and I was wondering how the REITs now, I'm about 15% invested in REITs in my portfolio, and does this start changing? Should I start looking at maybe not being in REITs so much?
What a relevant question. I think it's a really, that's something that I think we all are probably should be concerned about. And just a couple of quick background thoughts here. And for those just tuning in, let me give you some quick context. What Gerald's asking about real estate investment trust, REITs, REIT stands for Real Estate Investment Trust. They are a very similar structure to stocks. You can effectively classify them as stocks, but they're technically REITs. And the way they're structured, they pay out about 90% of their cash flow. So think of because we're in Atlanta, we all know Lenox Ball. It's owned by Simon Property Group, one of the very largest REITs in the country, in the world, quite frankly. And you think about their business model. They own the property. They own that giant departments. They own the mall. And then they lease the every little store to, whether it's Macy's, whether it is J. Crew, Banana Republic, or a jewelry store, or a restaurant. They collect that rent, and then they pass a big portion of that rent on to you as a form of a dividend distribution cash flow, right? Right now, if you looked at Vanguard REIT, VNQ symbol, low-cost way to access the whole REIT market, it pays around 4 or 4.5%. And that is fairly high current cash flow. But what's interesting about REITs, and Gerald, you probably know this because you're invested pretty heavily in REITs, it's been one of the very best asset classes to be in over the last 20 years. I just did a presentation this past week, and we had a chart of all the different, hey, over the last 20 years, the S&P 500, the bond market, gold, oil, international, REITs, guess who wins that long-term battle over the last 20 years as highest average rate of return? It's been the REIT market. And it's averaged almost 11% a year over the past 20 years. So it's had a really solid performance and again, a big chunk of that is income. Remember, if you're getting 4% every year and it's part of the, you get a little bit of gain on top of that and you have some really nice total return. Another really important point, I want to get to the specifics and the inner workings of all the different components within REITs in just a second, but the other thought, and I probably haven't talked about this enough, Gerald, the other thing you're probably worried about or wondering is that, hey, wait a minute, when interest rates go up, is that bad for REITs? Because they pay out a dividend, they are somewhat interest rate sensitive, and they react pretty significantly to rates going higher. And we know we're in an environment, or we believe we're in an environment where that's going to be the prevailing theme over the next couple of years. Hey, rates they went down this week because money went to safety and bought treasury bonds, pushed the prices up, pushes yields down. But over the next year or two, it's hard to imagine an environment where rates don't go higher. The Federal Reserve is pushing them higher, right?
Right.
Does that hurt rates? Yes, in the short term, and REITs typically do react because they're interest rate sensitive, and you saw it during the temper tantrum or the taper tantrum, taper tantrum in 2013. We saw it after the election when rates started to spike a little bit. REITs got hit from a price perspective, but interestingly, and this is kind of spoiler alert, that REITs do even better in rising interest rate environments, Gerald. So that they've averaged 10.9 over the last 20 some years, let's say. They've averaged about 18% per annum if you isolate the periods of time when rates are going up. And here's why. Yes, higher rates will compete with the yield of a REIT. 4% doesn't look as good when the Treasury's paying 4. It looks pretty good when the Treasury's only paying 2. But the reason rates should be going up, and historically, if rates are rising, it means the economy's getting better and better, right? It's the Fed said, hey, we can raise rates because the economy's pretty good. Well, REITs are economically sensitive. So if the economy's strong, a place like Simon Property Group, that owns Lenox Mall, despite, let's say, the retail apocalypse we're going through and you've got retailers going out of business, BB and BCBG and the Limited and Wet Seal. But if you think about it, if the economy is good, they've got a really good shot of just replacing them and saying, okay, well, we're not going to have a teen apparel retailer here anymore. We're going to swap that out for another retailer that has a better handle on the consumer. And hey, by the way, the consumer's in pretty darn good shape. Just because retailers, brick and mortar, some of those isolated retailers are not in good shape, it doesn't mean that the consumer isn't in good shape. We talked about that. So what does a company like Simon Property do? Well, they get new tenants. And those new tenants in a really strong economy, they have a lot to choose from, and they might even be able to raise the rent. So that's part of the reason we've seen historically REITs do even better when rates are going up. Now, back to your original question. If you look at the REIT index, yes, one of the biggest, if you go to VNQ, one of the biggest holdings is Simon Property Group, right? Mm-hmm. But you've got to remember that that's only one piece of the pie. REITs are the entire complex of commercial property. And even though retail is part of that, malls are part of that, there's a lot more to that marketplace. So if you think about public storage, you think about, you go by the side of the highway, you see these public storage type companies, that's a name of a company. You think of a place, these property management companies, you think of the hospital REITs or healthcare related REITs like Welltower. There's a lot more to the marketplace. Hotels, so host hotels and resorts. There's a lot of other REITs that are not tied directly to the consumer. They're tied to other industries, if you will. And when you're buying the REIT market, I think part of the success of that market has been that even though each one of these individual REIT areas, apartment complexes do well at certain periods of time, department stores might do well, you've got a lot of balance within that marketplace, Gerald. So just because retail's getting hit right now doesn't mean the whole REIT complex, which is multiple sectors within the broader context of real estate investment trust, commercial property in many forms, doesn't mean that the whole complex is going to get hit. In fact, as rates go up, it might even do better. 15% is pretty high for an allocation of REITs. So you probably have a fairly high risk tolerance. But I still think that because of the diversity within commercial property in America, hotels to apartment complexes to department stores to public storage, I still think long term it's a really good place to get income and then a little bit of a lift or total return as well, despite the thought that rates are going to continue to go up over the next several years. John joins us on the line from Buford. Good morning, John. Welcome to the Money Matters. What's going on? How can I help?
As I mentioned to your screener, I've got an investment vehicle. It's through a large insurance company. At the end of the day, it's tied to the S&P. It's going to mature fully in August. I've had it for 5 years. It's grown quite nicely, but at the end of the day, if it was what they call a B-structured security vehicle, and I guess the question is, what are my options when that thing matures, or should I just do it all over again?
Well, is it inside an IRA or a non-IRA account?
Yeah, it's IRA. It's IRA.
It's inside an IRA, so you can change it without any tax consequences, obviously, which is great. I guess my question here is that I go back to it sounds like this is an annuity, right? That's somewhat tied to the S&P 500, right?
Correct.
How much did you put in it and how much is it worth today?
Just approximately. Five years ago, I put in just under 50 and it's about 82 grand. It's a small piece of my total portfolio, but I want to do something with it.
And are there restrictions? So this is interesting. So it only has about a 5-year restriction to it?
Yes.
and you're ready to go. Well, it sounds like you are. Now, were there also, is this a variable annuity or some sort of equity index annuity? Do you remember?
I'm not really sure.
Okay. Sounds a little bit like a variable annuity to me, but it's
probably
it's hard to tell exactly, but it sounds like it's been similar to the S&P 500. I mean, over the last 5 years, S&P 500 is up about 70 or about 80%. You're up at about 65, which is, it's basically tracked the market with a little bit of a lag, which, so it's done pretty well. I think that I go back to, if it's inside an IRA, it's just another investment vehicle. When you have a variable annuity like this, and you've got a bunch of choices, S&P 500, the international index, a bond index, it's a lot like just a 401k plan where you can choose your own options. The question typically is that, is there some sort of income benefit that you can enact for the rest of your life? How old are you?
65.
All right, 65, time to, so, and are you about ready?
Yeah.
Well, you've got what, you said about a year to 50, about a year and a half to retirement?
August 2018.
Wow, it's coming up. How exciting is that, by the way, John?
Actually, it's kind of scary.
It is scary, isn't it? So I guess my question is that, out of the other assets that you have, this makes up what percentage? Is this 10% of the family pie, or is this a big chunk of it?
Probably about 13%
of the overall.
Yeah.
Which means that for you, well, that's pretty specific. So you've got about $600,000-$700,000 of money invested elsewhere, right? Here's my thought, John, is that when you're in a product that is a lot like a mutual fund, part of the conversation we're having today, right now, we're talking about these active funds versus passive funds. In qualification, what you're using right now, an annuity from a big German insurance company, AXA, Allianz, Prudential is obviously from the United States, but most of these companies are providing you with just another investment vehicle that has a lot of cost to it. Doesn't mean it's a bad investment vehicle, and to your point here, this has grown pretty nicely. It sounds like it's in an S&P 500-like fund. The S&P's up 80%, you're up 65%. So it's done pretty well over the last 5 years, like it should have if it's tied to the market. The problem that a lot of these variable annuities have is that they are really expensive. They cost 2 to 3, sometimes even 4% a year. So I'm not against all of these investment products because they have their own merit, and sometimes there is a benefit to owning an annuity for a particular person in a particular situation that might make a little bit of sense. However, if John, you're telling me, hey, Wes, I want a balanced approach. I want this to produce income. And there are other vehicles that you can own, and there obviously are through lower cost ETFs that don't cost you 2 or 3% a year, then I'd say that you can look at something that is a lot more efficient, that's running a much cleaner race than having an annuity that's tied to the S&P 500 that costs you 3% a year. There's no reason for that.
Now back to Wes Moss and the money and investing advice you need.
So the question is, what does better? Is it true that the majority of active funds are bested by their index fund counterparts? Again, some do and some don't. So a standard, but it's, again, it's not nearly as one-sided as the headlines make it out to be. Standard & Poor's just did a study highlighted in the Wall Street Journal a couple weeks ago. It says that more than 90% of actively managed large cap equity funds. So this is in one particular category, by the way, just to qualify this. In large cap equity funds, they underperform, 90% of them underperform the index over the last 15 years. Okay, wait a minute. Okay. That's a real advertisement to ditch your active funds and use index funds or use ETFs, right? On the other side of the spectrum, PIMCO and Morningstar, again, a lot of credibility behind that, show that the majority of active bond funds, so now we're talking about a different category, hence part of the confusion in this argument. So the majority of active bond funds and bond ETFs, by the way, do in fact beat their index fund counterparts. Okay, well, that's two giant companies doing these giant longitudinal studies, and they're saying different things. But remember, they're saying different things about different areas of the market. One's large cap stocks, one's bonds. The data confirms that in most bond categories, short-term bonds, high-yield bonds, intermediate bonds, and the list goes on, index funds trailed their active fund counterparts over the last 1, 3, 5, 7, and 10 years. Again, I'll say it again. Index funds trailed their active funds over a 1, 3, 5, 7, and 10 year period. Interestingly, 63% of these active funds and ETFs beat their passive index over the last 5 years. So that's a very different story, isn't it, from this big argument. The study goes on to say that stock or equity funds, again, they don't fare quite as well against their passive competition, but about a third of them, very different, by the way, than the S&P study, about a third of active stock funds do beat their passive competition on a 1, 3, 5, 7, and 10 year basis. That's very different than the Standard & Poor's study, isn't it? Mostly due to how each study categorizes these funds that are, and there's a bunch of them that are no longer in existence. So funds will get merged together. Funds will go away. The manager will retire and he'll close up shop. Remember, an active fund is run by active people. People have lives. Lives change. They don't do it forever. They might do it for 15 or 20 or 30 years.
Assured Capital Solutions is now offering same-day availability of funds when we process the checks you receive from your customers. Can your bank do that? Get your business funds in minutes, not days. And with Assured